Hello, wall. Hello, stacker machine. Act one. Two swans on a mirror hung 3 feet from the stage. In the mirror's green shadow, a dark mass, blood and clothes, then unseen strings lift a man by his shoulders. He climbs through the mirror, shaking riverweed from his hair, as the pit moans the music of bows against air and the clatter of valves pumping empty space. The man stands on the edge of the mirror and pries an axe from his chest, while his boat swallows fire, decarbons from black to wood, is remoored. The massacre, pantomimed in reverse, vignettes of slaughter unplayed on the stage under 323 spotlights. The little twins clasp hands, unwind rope from the other's neck. A woman folds up the billowing red cloth from her child's throat. The young teacher sits, mending her dress, plucking pellets from her chest. One by one they exit, as stagehands in black carry the mirror away, leaving one actor splayed on the stage. He heaves up coughing grass from his mouth. Mirek, the traitor, the first killed that morning. They stuffed his mouth because he refused credit, told them to eat grass if they were hungry. He jimmies a scythe from his ribs and plucks the arrows, one for each baby he fathered, then left for coyotes. Turns his head, shakes out bullets, one for his language, one for his money, then stands, opens his arms, bows. Center, left, right, center. He exits, leaving the stage empty, except for its carpet of teeth, and questions dangling like flesh from mouths. I've been working on a long poem called Belle Isle. Belle Isle was a Confederate prison during the Civil War, and an ancestor of mine actually, he fought for the Union Army and he managed to escape from Belle Isle prison. And I was able to obtain his records from the National Archive. And I wrote a long poem based on his experience, but I just totally made everything up. But it's really long, so I'm just going to read a couple of sections. This is Belle Isle. Skittish as barn cats, guards gather around a white horse, legs buckled under, knee bloody, mouth frothing, killing stuck in their craws, can't stand the taste no more. The guards hand us torches and we touch them to the dry grass. I kneel in front of her, light the brush beneath her face. Fly away now, girl. She raises her head like she's swimming across the river, trying to keep her face dry above the water. I whisper to the dead, avoid suck holes, come up for air, don't kick if you sink, remember the girl gone missing. Boats weave water, cannons call the body up. 4 days before she rose, twisting like a pupa, reed fish, river bride, wing body. How could that body be so heavy? 4 days without ration. A thief took my blanket. He said, only bird here. I see her open great gray wings just above water. Saint eel, mud halo, moth gut. We were boys watching a girl's body yanked by rope from water. We were boys listening to grief cleave the throat. We were boys, and after we went looking for blackberries, threw stones at a rabbit and said we were going to catch crawdaddies, but never found a jar. The wall shoulders night like a pallbearer, like an iron wheel under freight. The man prophesizes machinery and time. He speaks to his wound like a lover. He prophesizes locust trees and dahlias and sweet pea blossoms in winter and the coming of great shaggy pines, their roots prying apart the machines, caging the gears. I tell him my brother is alive. I must find him and be human. I must go have a daughter, a garden, maybe a small shop and a neighbor I fish with. The man tells me I am mad, tells me to give the human his empty palm. I think of the lost girl, her body's dance as it is lifted from the water. I think of loving her, of taking her to see horses on the hillside, how her mouth would smell like wheat or earth just turned and fresh for planting, or your hand after you sit on the trestle in the sun and hold the iron rail. I turn to her, but I hold a dying man. I shoulder him like the wall. I drag him to where we burned the horse. Could be we escape through ash and rib. Could be we cross, track the river northwest, find her asleep in the reeds.
Oh, thanks. There's actually a little more, if that's okay. It's way out of time. It's like the Academy Awards. They're like, you're done.
I kick as I sink, then memory stills me. I'm falling into the water of evening, trying to hold the man steady as he clasps his wound or his whistle. He lifts his face from the river, turning into a rock that keeps me upright above my reflection. They're coming, get going. William, alive, he made himself into a tree, into an echo of get going. My brother is alive, is a river, is moss spreading over my palm to keep it from cutting the rock. My brother is sitting on the trestle with me. We are waiting for the late train to pass and the man with the lantern in the boxcar to call. Good evening, boys.
Okay, thanks.
Just so you don't think I'm totally unaware of the body of American literature, that last section with a boxcar is based on a James Wright poem, and I did that because my ancestors are actually from Martins Ferry, Ohio, so the gentleman who managed to escape made his way back to Martins Ferry. I really like to work on long poems and series, and I'm currently working on a series about a magical archive that contains a limitless collection. And the main narrator in the poem is researching an incident known as the Minnesota Massacre, the Dakota War, or the Sioux Rebellion, depending on what year the text you're reading was written. I don't know. In this poem, some of the librarians are part machine, and this librarian is able to illuminate the archive with his hands. And the only other thing you know is that the Sioux Rebellion began with a power struggle between two brothers, and one brother shot his brother through the wrists, and his brother survived. If you go to the Minnesota Historical Society, you can see the bones with the bullets in them. This is called What the Archive Hides in Its Benthic Dark. Beneath the archive, Poseidon and Neptune doze with nameless sea gods of jettisoned civilizations, jarred eels doubled into pouting hooks, ancient creatures mostly mouth, laconic clicks of commuting whales. Jellyfish, mistaking the glow of the librarian's palms, swarm. Breath of their bells causes our skin. We drift past Pliny's lurid monsters, Aristotle's unadorned shark, the diving bell where Alexander witnessed a creature so large it took 3 days to swim past. And on, plucked by the curious mouths of luminous creatures, skirted by anglerfish fused into their mates, eyed by mud-sloshing sea cucumbers galloping over snuff-colored sand. There, the bench my brother and I shared when he was forced to repeat biology, squid pinned open on the tray, silence stitched into flesh. Pressure stoppers questions as a librarian pulls me to a pile of dredging buckets from which he produces a metal case. As we ascend, jellyfish unfurl silky limbs from our wrists, and the sound of celebrants singing death in the reading room grows louder. Half blind and wrung from pressure, I let him shove me out the door. Bury them, proper, he says, and jigs into the fet. My car is hot in the noon sun, and I shake as I crack the hinge beneath barnacles, unwrap burlap, helix of radius and ulna, pearly clutch of corpus, fault line spider around a plug of lead. I touch the bullet's flattened head. Two brothers at the edge of a river where they once dove for pumpkin seeds. The bones creak and snap along their faults. Is it the heat, the light? I roll down the windows, blast the air conditioner, shade the box with my hand. Too late, it's empty except for burlap rot and two bullets, stubborn as siblings.
The archive has a collection of historic clothing, and this is a poem that's in the voice of those clothing. It's called Intermission. We rise and uncreak the creases. We rise, applause, dislodging dust from doveskin. We rise and go, silk and tulle, whalebone and waistcoat, pleat and pearl. We rise in chemises and shifts, stockings and redingotes, chintz and taffeta and go. In the lobby, we gather in clutches of sleeves and slacks, cabals of houndstooth and hoop skirts, bundles of buckles and stomachers. We spill speeches, lines, mummified wine from goblets and glasses, mugs and steins. Meanwhile, the puppeteers prepare for act two, stringing bones on gold wire. We are the bones that filled the dresses, that held the skin, that lifted the bodices, that blushed beneath fichu, that cooed black Alison lace, that fingered the piping, that pressed its corset against another's corsage and sighed the seams near bursting. Rather, we are the memory of those bones, linen pinched at the knee, trumpet sleeves gaping at the elbow, crushed panniers, rosettes, trailing tendrils of threads. We are the bones that cradled the organs, stomach, liver, heart. We are the string, we are the sex, we are the memory of ligament, we are the ball of muscle at the base of the tongue, we are the Latin of its name. We are playbills and stubs, that is to say we are ephemera, advertisements, broadsides, brochures, faces, hands, lips, and eyes. We are suits and jackets, swill and surge. We are the tide bundled against the shore, bundled against the door, wanting out into the air, into what will make us decay, the only way we know to join the living. We are hermetic and hermeneutic, dry as a cat's breath, and we miss the oil of our owners, their skin and its secretions. We miss the spit of the little girl chewing our ribbons, the sweat of the suitor yanking our cuffs, the wet that seeps into our weft from the woman spun by her lover into the quadrille's turn. We want our seams to tear with a fumble, a child to grow out of us, a gate to make a side split, frugality to transform us into quilt or rag. We talk with our collars, confound with our stitching, tattle with our smell. We are ghosts of flesh and partners of presence. We are attendants, waiting on you, wanting only to be worn again. So the end of, oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Dakota Wars ended with what is still the largest mass execution in American history. 37 Sioux or Dakota men were hung in Mankato's town square on December 28th, 1862. And because they were tried by a military court, Abraham Lincoln had to sign all the death warrants. And he was originally sent 307 death warrants. And he ended up whittling them down to 38. And this poem is called Unsure of His Decision. Lincoln still reads testimony in the archive, and it contains pieces of the actual testimony. The librarians know enough to let him leave the lamp on long after everything has been reshelved. From the highway, the lit window, petroglyph palm print in the Minnesota dark. He remembers reading about a language without vowels. Ox, plow, man with arms raised to the sky. We have been executing each other for that long, he thinks, orders written in phases of the moon. I was at the fort. I went with the others to die. The vowels are the thing, he decides, the linchpin of my errors. Later, doesn't care about the vowels. This little Indian skirmish isn't his war, Chancellorville, Shiloh, Middle Creek, Sherman inching to the sea. This man tended horses. They were very poor, him and his family.
isn't his war, yet the telegram delivers a death warrant, 307 long Indian names. What's it to him, this general out there in the barely American nowhere, authoring missives on justice like some mad barbaric philosopher, reading auguries in the grizzle of settlers, scrawling engineering of trussing up 307 men, fretting over having enough rope? Appomattox, Cockle Creek, Amelia Springs, let him have his marvel of fulcrum, joist, and brace. What if I did it? Just signed, 307 handfuls of letters gone, paint blown against a cave wall. I am a professional juggler, and a young girl came to me. Isn't his war, yet court transcripts arrive, slender stack of paper, rush script, 40 men per day, 5 minutes of testimony each. The first time I heard of the trouble, I was making hay. How to discern murder from war? He had a new hat, a soft gray hat. From hats and wagons and horses and laundry lines and fence posts and harvests and memory and maybes and dinners left cooling on the table. The woman's clothes were turned up and the old man turned them down. But mostly from silences and blanks, so many they pile around his desk, fill any available box, cram in closets, take over offices. The librarians come before dawn to catalog the blanks, and he still squints under the lamp, folding and unfolding the letter, rereading the list of names he chose for death, the names he chose to pardon. I was at Fort Ridgely. I stood near the stables. He rereads the testimony, checks to see if he copies the names correctly, looks for letters lost, vowels forgotten. I have sore eyes. I cannot shoot anything. I have taken up planting on account of them. The librarians have been cataloging guilt for centuries, slipping tin into acid-free envelopes, building custom boxes for curved tines. She asked, "Where are we going?" I said, "I don't know." They ship the boxes to bunkers to be stored below ground as he folds and unfolds the letter. They say nothing, though his ungloved hands worry the paper. It's already beyond repair. So I have just one more, and I wanted to thank you so much for asking me to read, and for having this series for so long. It's great. Jimmy, thank you. The summer can be really bleak for cultural events, so it's really great that you're having it. Now that I say that, I regret that I said it's bleak. So this is my final poem. I don't have a title for it. And it's also in the archive series. And thanks again, and thanks so much. I'm really excited to hear the next three readers. We are only shuttling information. The information comes to us as if we are looking into the sky and seeing only the flash of white on the underside of a wing, not the bird. Comes as seven hoof prints left by the deer in the mud where the camp once stood. We are only the mud unmarked next to the historical site where the second year history student dresses as a pioneer woman and shows how they did laundry back then. Back then, a funny time when people had to boil their clothes. Back then, when they wrote with metal nibs and kept inkpots on their desk. We are only the speckles of ink left on the general's writing desk. There he wrote, "I find the greatest difficulty keeping my men from the Indian women." He wrote, "The poor women's wailing, I dislike to go in person to their lodges." We are only a man's memory of women's voices, the voices themselves vanished. We are only the vanishing of snow, only the fistful of snow the woman crammed in her mouth to burn her memory, the fistful of snow the woman crammed in her mouth to distinguish this day from the others, the snow the woman crammed in her mouth to stop the screaming within. We are only unrecorded, the suicide who walked into the current before another soldier came. We are only the memory of eels cradling the body as it sank and the prayer of eels curled among the bones. We are only the comfort of eels sliding through her ribs to say, "We remember." We are only water and we could not rise up without rain, rise up and save her. Instead, we offer memory. And our memory is only as good as our archive, where your names are not recorded, your deaths unremarked, your numbers uncounted. We are only the blanks of women, and we carry these blanks inside of us as the sky carries the white beneath a wing. Thanks again.